And tonight, I want to talk to you about a subject, I guess you'd say the subject of depression, or despondency, or despair. But I want to begin by asking a question. Which Bible character do you relate to better than any other? I'm kind of a little bit afraid to mention names, because all the people I want to name, the person I want to relate to, are too great. And I'm not like them very much at all, sometimes I think. I like David, because he was a man after God's own heart. And I like John, who was more than a prophet. And Peter, who was a rock in the kingdom. And Paul, who was a fervent evangelist. And Barnabas, who was called a great, you know, the encourager. I'd like to relate to those guys to me. But sometimes I don't measure up to them. More humbly, I might relate to those in Jesus' parables, like the publican who says, God be merciful to me, I'm a sinner. Or the centurion who just says, I'm not worthy. But instead of us trying to identify who we think that we relate to in the Bible, it'd be a little bit more interesting to find out who God identifies us with. And he does that in the book of James, chapter 5, and around verse 14. And I want to start reading there when he says, is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church. Let them pray over him and anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer offered in faith will restore the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. And if he has committed any sins, they'll be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another so that you may be healed. The effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. And then he says, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. And he prayed earnestly that it might not rain, and it didn't rain on the earth for 3 years and 6 months. He prayed again, and the sky poured down rain, and the earth produced its fruit. I find it interesting that he says Elijah is a man who has a nature like ours. This is kind of intimidating to me to ever compare myself to Elijah's nature. Because Elijah, he's a guy that I want to be like, but I don't think I am very often. He was a hero. He's kind of like an Old Testament hero that is revived and held up before us several times in the New Testament. He's a, you know, John the Baptist said he came in the spirit and the power of Elijah. And he shows up on the Mount of Transfiguration to console the Lord and along with Moses before his death. And he's so great that even some of the Jews thought that Jesus was Elijah. And James uses him as a model of that prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. So, but interesting that Elijah had a nature kind of like ours. And I want to think about him with you for just a few minutes tonight. And I want to start by just thinking for a minute or two about the high points of his career. Think about some things that you remember about Elijah. And to do that, you need to go back to your Old Testament, to the book of 1 Kings. That's where his story is told. And chapter 17, this is where we meet Elijah. And the first place, of course, that we meet him is in the palace of a king. And we know that king was a man named Ahab. In chapter 17, 1, 2, 3, it says, Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the settlers of Gilead, said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives before whom I stand, surely there should be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. And the word of the Lord came to him, saying, go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. So here he just kind of, when we meet Elijah, it's just really sudden. It's you know, powerful and dramatic. He walks into the throne room of this great king, this wicked king, and points his finger in his face, and he says, no more dew, no more rain until I say so. And he turns around and he walks out. I mean, that's bold. Or he was stupid. But you know, we think, who would dare approach? And anybody who knows the Bible knows Ahab was like the worst of the worst. He was the Darth Vader of the Old Testament kings. But he walks in and he says, no more rain, no more dew until I say so. And then he walks out. And then the Lord, of course, says, you need to go and down to this brook, hide yourself by the brook Cherith, and I'll take care of you. I'll provide for you provisions, food, and etc. And he stays there by this brook until his next assignment, which is not long coming, because without rain, the brook dries up, and there's no food. And so the Lord tells him, you know, I want you to go to a place called Zarephath, a city that was in the territory of the Gentiles. And so you get that story, beginning in verse 8 of chapter 17. The Lord came, said, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, stay there. I've commanded a widow there to provide for you. So he arose, he went to Zarephath. When he came there to the gate of the city, a widow was there gathering sticks, and she called. And he called to her and said, please give me a little water in a jar that I can drink it. And as she was going, he also said to her, please, can you bake me a cake too? And this woman, that stopped her in her tracks. Water is okay. I mean, she's going to be kind and give this guy some water, which was a lot to ask in a time of famine. But when he says, give me a cake, she stopped. She says, what? What? I mean, she says, you know, as the Lord your God lives, I have no bread. Only a handful of flour and a bowl and a little oil in a jar. And I'm going to gather in a few sticks. I'm going to go and make and prepare for me and my son that we may eat it and die. This is my last meal. And you want me to give you something to eat? And he says, yeah, you go make me a cake first. And I will guarantee you that you will have all the bread and oil that you need until the rains return. And she does it, which is really impressive. I mean, this is a lady that showed a lot of faith. And what's impressive, he didn't work any miracles for her. Not that we're told anyway. I mean, I don't know on what basis, except maybe generosity or something that she does this, but no miracles. But she gives him a piece of this, her last meal. And obviously, and she's rewarded for that. Exactly what happens comes to pass. And not too long after that, though, the son of this woman gets sick, and he dies. And she blames Elijah. Verse 17, came about after these things that the son of this woman, the mistress of the house, became sick. And his sickness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she says to Elijah, what do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and put my son to death. And then Elijah takes her son, and he goes in to the with the son, and in a private room, and he lays him on the bed, and he prays to the Lord and says, my Lord, O God, hast thou also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? He stretches himself out on the child three times, and the Lord's and he prays, and the Lord gives the life back to the child, raises the dead. I'm not sure, this may be the first case in the Old Testament where someone was raised from the dead. And he gives the woman her son back, and it says at the end, in verse 24, the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is surely the truth. I can imagine the hearts of Israel and how they would swell as they would pass these stories around. These stories of their great heroes. I mean, this is an incredible man. I mean, that he would have the courage and the boldness to go and address the wicked king, and that the Lord would send him to Zarephath, and he would raise this woman's son from the dead. And you know, that would have been impressive. He was a hero. I mean, that when you say the law and the prophets, that was Moses and Elijah. He was the epitome of the prophets. But I think no story of Elijah could really top the one that comes in the next chapter. That's chapter 18. If you look there, this I would say has to be the high point of Elijah's career. There's still a famine. It's the third year of the famine. The conditions are evidently horrendous. They're terrible. The queen, Jezebel, has already killed most of the real prophets. She's already had them all annihilated. There's a few, they're hidden, but for the most part, she's killed them all. And God sends Elijah to meet with Ahab. Time to go see him again. And Obadiah, who is evidently over the household of Ahab, encounters Elijah first. And Elijah says, go tell Ahab, I want to talk to him. And Obadiah says, oh, he says, I don't know about that. He says, you seem to keep disappearing at the wrong time. And I'm not so sure that I want to go tell Ahab that you're here. And when he gets here, you're going to be gone. And he's going to kill me. And Elijah says, no, you go get him, and I'll be here. So he goes and gets Ahab, and when he arrives, the first thing that comes out of Ahab's mouth is he says, Well, he says, behold, Elijah's here. And when Ahab arrives, he says, is that you, O troubler of Israel? Is that you, you old troublemaker? And Elijah says, that's verse 17 of chapter 18. And Elijah says, no. He said, that's not me. It's the other way around. You're the one who's the troubler of Israel. You're the one who's the troublemaker here. And of course, you know, that sets up this huge confrontation on the top of Mount Carmel. And you have, on the top of that in that story, you have 450 prophets of Baal, you have 400 prophets of the Asherah, and you have one lone ranger on the other side of the mountain. And that's Elijah. And you really do need to visualize the discrepancy in the size of the masses that are, and perhaps King Ahab, the wickedest of all, is standing there with him, and here is Elijah on the other side. And he issues a challenge. Well, he feels like he's all alone. That may be worth mentioning too. Verse 22 is the first place that Elijah says to the people, I'm alone. And I alone am left, the prophet of the Lord. That Baal's prophets are 450 men. I'm all alone. There's nobody else. I'm the only one. At least that was his perception. And so he issues a challenge to the people. He says, you need to make a choice. How long will you hesitate? Verse 21, 22 opinions. If the Lord is God, follow Him. If Baal is God, follow Him. And the people don't say anything. Of course, they're not idiots. I mean, he's alone. And on the other side is Ahab and all of his prophets. And they're probably thinking, you know, we're not ready to stick our neck out here. Because Ahab, they feared him. They feared that king. So they said, we're not going to say anything. And so he proposes a test. We're going to offer two sacrifices. And you offer one to your God, I'll offer one to mine. And let's see who answers. And the one who answers by fire, he's the Lord. And they all say, that's a good idea. We can go with that. And so the Baal's prophets, as many of you know the story, builds their altar. And they begin to cry out, trying to get their God's attention. And you know, this place is, there hasn't been any rain for 3 years. So one spark from one of those knives, as they're flashing those knives around, and one spark, man, and the whole place is going up in smoke. It's just a tinderbox. But nothing happens. So we know Elijah sort of mocks them. And then Elijah, it's his turn. And they're frustrated, and they're watching the whole Elijah. And here's this lone figure. And he starts to pick up stones. 12 stones. And he builds an altar. It's kind of been amazing. I don't know how big those stones were. But they just, you know, everybody's watching him. And here he is, and he builds his altar. And then he makes a trench around the altar. Puts the ox on there, what he's going to sacrifice. And he starts dumping water on it. He saturates it. Saturates the sacrifice. And all the water pours off the altar and starts filling the trench around it. So there's not a chance on the planet it's going to burn. And then in verse 36, it says, it came about at that time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that Thou art God in Israel, that I am Your servant, and that I have done all these things at Thy word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that Thou, O Lord, art God, that Thou hast turned their heart back again. And the fire of the Lord fell, consumed the burnt offering and the wood, and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. I don't think it's hard to imagine a more dramatic story in the Bible, a more dramatic display of the reality of God in the Bible. And I don't know, I think that probably had to be the high point of Elijah's career. His calmness under extreme pressure. His courageousness, his boldness, he has no fear. He doesn't show it anyway. His trust in the Lord against all odds. After he offers a sacrifice, he sends the people, he says, kill those prophets. And so there's this massive slaughter of all the prophets, the false prophets. And Elijah prays to God 3 times, and the rain returns after 3 years. And then Elijah, with superhuman strength, sort of, he outruns Ahab's chariot back to Jezreel. I always visualize that. I see it. Ahab probably trying to run him down. But he can't catch up to him, and he stays out in the front, and he leads the chariot back to Israel. Beats Ahab back to Israel running. And we'd say, boy, I'd like to have a nature like that. You know? But I'm sure I'm not quite ready to claim that kind of courageousness and boldness. But that's not the end of the story, is it? It's ironic. Now, when you think about this, that the low point of Elijah's career comes immediately after the high point. And I want you to think about the low point of his career now. Down in verse 9, chapter 19, the story continues. So why don't we read verses 1 through 5. It says, now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. I think he's a whiner. You know, he goes and tells his wife. He does that later too, whenever he won't give him Naboth the vineyard. But he goes and tells his wife. And Jezebel sends out a messenger to Elijah. And he says, so may the gods do to me, and even more, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow, about this time. And he was afraid. And he arose and ran for his life. And he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. And he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. And he came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, it is enough now, O Lord. Take my life, for I am no better than my fathers. And he laid down and he slept under the juniper tree. Beersheba is about 95 miles south of Mount Carmel. So that's probably, unless he still was running with superhuman strength, which I don't know, I don't get the impression that's how that worked. But that probably took him 3 days, at least, to get there. That was a long trip. And before he gets to his destination, he dismisses his young servant, who probably was too exhausted to continue. And Elijah goes on and finishes the trip alone. And he gets to a tree, and he sits down to rest. And he sits there, alone. And he's exhausted physically, no doubt about it. But he seems that he's very depressed, psychologically. And he says, because he says, take my life. Just take my life. Because I am no better than my father's. He at least shows a lot of classic symptoms of people who, that are common to people who are discouraged. People who are distressed, in kind of a despairing type disposition, and despondent. He seems to be brokenhearted. He's disgusted. He withdraws himself from others. He sleeps. He contemplates death. He feels worthless. He lumps himself in with others who failed. He feels like a failure. And you know, he also, if you look a little bit further down, he goes further. God speaks to him at that point and sends him a little bit further, which is kind of interesting, to another area, another location. Let's read a little bit further. Verse 6. He looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake. I skipped the part about the angel. He lays down and sleeps, and then behold, there's an angel that touches him. And he said to him, arise and eat. And he looks, and behold, there's at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and he drank, and he lay down again. It's amazing, after you meet an angel, and then you eat, and then you can lay down and sleep again. He must have really been tired. And he lays down again. And so he arose, and he ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, to the mountain of God. And he came there to a cave, and he lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, what are you doing, Elijah? And he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant. They've torn down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. And they seek my life too, to take it away. So he goes 40 days and 40 nights. Now he's at a mountain in Hor. That's a long way. I mean, that is a long way. And he's lonely. And he kind of shows a little bit of self-pity. You know, he's still talking about how he alone is left. But you know what? And I thought about that. This is not a really, maybe I should ask you, but I don't think this is an unreasonable state of mind that a person might experience. Idolatry absolutely controls his nation, and he stands the exact opposite in his way of thinking. He is a one God man, but his entire nation, he thinks, is idolatrous. The king and queen who ought to be the models of for the nation are two of the wickedest people that you could possibly have in leadership. They killed all the prophets they could find, and he's got a price on his head, and this is a queen that can make good on her threats and promises. And he has done the greatest thing that he can imagine possible. I mean, he has shown the entire nation which God is real and which is false. I mean, it's like he can say, you know, we have done everything that a person can do. But Carmel was a failure. And I'm a failure just like all the others. Maybe the others, his fathers in this case, maybe the other prophets. I don't know. I don't know which fathers he's talking about. Maybe others who tried to do the same thing he did. But he lumps himself in with all these others. I can understand. That's not an unreasonable type of mindset to be in. I want to suggest to you some causes of discouragement in his life that could also be causes of people's discouragement today. One, again, I want to go back to what I said earlier, that it's ironic that the low point, his low point immediately followed his high point. And sometimes we have, you know, great spiritual victories can make us vulnerable to discouragement. I don't know about you, but you can feel, you know, when you have some great things happen in your life and there are victories and you win some battles and you're doing great spiritually, you don't expect anything to go bad. You just kind of expect everything just to continue in the same way. You kind of were on the spiritual plateau is high and you just think it ought to continue right on. And Elijah was expecting great things. Perhaps he was expecting the revival of the nation. I mean, he expected what happened on Mount Carmel to cause everybody to change in his nation. And either maybe they would even oust the wicked king and queen, or perhaps even they would be converted. I don't know, but he was expecting great things. And he expected his faithfulness and his devotion to the Lord to lead, you know, to cause others to be faithful as well. But the challenge issued by Jezebel was just not in his forecast of the future. That was not what he saw coming. And I think the same thing can happen to us. That great expectations, but when the reverse comes, we have great expectations of things, and then when the opposite comes, it just drops us right on our heads. And maybe some of that's due to pride. I don't know, but sometimes that's what happens. Or when we have great spiritual victories, we can kind of be proud and expect other things just to continue in the same direction. Maybe we make a great choice and follow Christ. Maybe we're extremely devoted and we're become a great servant in God's kingdom, just doing a lot and helping everybody. And then all of a sudden, everything that we expect to happen fails. We have difficulties. We have hard times. Other people are not faithful that maybe we expect to be faithful. There are problems in our family or the church. Somehow it lets us down and disappoints us. Or maybe we're shunned by others when we expect everybody to kind of rally around us and be supportive. It just wasn't in the forecast. I just didn't imagine that. And no one prepared us for that. And so it's kind of strange, I think. But spiritual victories sometimes make us very vulnerable to discouragement. And when things are going well, our expectations are great. And then when things turn out for the reverse, in the reverse, we get discouraged. So I think that's one thing that can happen. Another is sometimes we don't get the results that we want when we want them. He had years of faithfulness behind him. Now he's got the death of all the false prophets before him, and yet nothing really changed. Nothing changed in Israel about that time. It was very discouraging. It's very hard when you work and work and work and work and for something, and then you don't see any positive results. And I think there's others that kind of had that experience sometime. Noah, you know, he preached the entire time that he built the ark, but he only saved his family. That's kind of discouraging results. And Jesus was despised and rejected. And he felt, based on what he saw, that what he did was a failure. Well, look that up in Isaiah chapter 49. It was a failure. And some of the most diligent servants of the Lord have experienced the frustration of seeing little, just very little, good that comes from all of their efforts and hard labor. And that can be a discouraging thing, can be a depressing thing, can be a create despair in people at times. And another thing is that sometimes we commiserate with ourselves and we feel sorry for ourselves, and that can lead to discouragement and depression. I alone am left. He said that twice. He must have really thought it. He believed there was nobody else, just him. And it's kind of hard not to get discouraged when you feel or when you convince yourself that you're all alone. Sometimes that is the case. Joshua and Caleb virtually stood alone. I guess Moses was with them, but Joshua and Caleb were virtually alone when they came back from the mission to spy out the land, and everybody else disagreed. The 10 spies said, it's a terrible decision. And they wanted to stone them. They kind of had to stand alone. And then at a critical moment in Paul's life, he was abandoned by everyone, 2 Timothy, when he stood on trial the first time. He said, everybody left me. They all deserted me. All these supporters, they're just gone. I had to stand alone. And Elijah was feeling that everybody else but him had abandoned the Lord. Usually we don't get that discouraged when I'm focused on the work of the Lord. But when we think mainly about ourselves, oh, woe is me, discouragement is not too far behind. And we can do that. But he commiserated with himself, felt sorry for himself. And that's a cause of depression. Also, we feel guilty sometimes for abandoning our responsibility. And I think he probably, to some degree, felt some guilt for that. He was a prophet, and he was acting without the direction of God. God did not send him to Beersheba. He went, and God showed up, and he said, what are you doing here, Elijah? I didn't send you here. This was not for my direction that you went to Beersheba. And so I think he feels guilty and sort of defensive when the Lord speaks to him. He says, what are you doing? And he said, I've been very zealous for the Lord. That's not a, I'm really sorry, I've really abandoned my post, and will you forgive me and restore me? It's I've done all that I can do. It's defensive. And I've been zealous, and everybody else has broken your covenant. They tore down your altars, and I alone am left. What else am I supposed to do? really, he was in need of forgiveness. And he needed to return to his post. But guilt can produce depression. Sometimes when we are broken in our spirit, we don't need to search for some artificial stimulant to make us feel better. We just need to repent and get back to work. But there are others. Maybe you can see some others in this story that I didn't see. I'm sure there are other causes of discouragement that take place in people that bring them down and cause them to have difficulties. But God's question, how does God deal with the despondent? How does he deal with a man who is in despair? Well, when he meets him, he says, what are you doing here, Elijah, in verse 9? And then again, when he meets with him again at the Mount of the Lord, he says, what are you doing here, Elijah, in verse 13? I want you to... First thing I noticed as I read about when God encountered him is he doesn't condemn him, doesn't get angry with him, doesn't get annoyed with him, and he doesn't abandon him. Sometimes we can be very critical of people who suffer from depression and despair. Sometimes we can run them down. Or we use somebody else's discouragement to build up our own egos because they just aren't tough enough and we're tougher than they are. We need to be careful not to be critical. In the Bible, it's not the weak or the half-hearted or the hypocrite that God chooses to note as having periods of depression and discouragement. Rather, the heroes, like Elijah and Job, went through a period of discouragement. And Jesus went through a period of discouragement. And Paul went through periods of discouragement and despair. And I think that can be helpful to us when we experience it ourselves, and it can be a warning to those who might look down with contempt on others who are going through it. And while God doesn't say, having said that, while God doesn't say to Job, snap out of, or to him, Elijah, snap out of it, or you're just upset over nothing, neither does he pamper him and encourage him to continue in it. He didn't pamper him. We shouldn't abandon people with contempt who go through discouragement, but we should not merely try to just make them feel better. We need to challenge them. And that's what God does with him. We need to challenge them and help them to get up and do the work of the Lord. He says to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" It's kind of sort of like, again, you kind of deserted your post. You're not doing the work that a prophet ought to be doing. You can't accomplish anything here in this cave. This is not where you're going to get the work of the Lord done. And Elijah doesn't understand that at first. He feels like there's nothing he can do. Feels like there's he's all alone. It's too late. There's nothing to come back to. We tried everything, but God keeps working with him. He keeps working with him. And he challenges him again. What are you doing here? And then he offers him some things to help him get back on the road again. Let's start reading verse 11 and 12. He meets him in the cave. Elijah's in a cave at this at the mountain. And he says, "Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing." Well, first of all, God does appear to Elijah. I mean, in a sense, in a very dramatic, in a very powerful way. Wind, earthquake, fire. He's just tearing the mountain apart. And, you know, in each one of those, there's a very dramatic and powerful display of God's power or his presence. And I think that Elijah needed to see that very desperately. And he needed confidence that the Lord was there and to see who was really on his side. I mean, especially, remember, he's being hunted by Jezebel. I mean, his life is on the line. And he doesn't know where did God go. You know, where is this God that was on Mount Carmel that delivered me when I need him now? And I think seeing those marvelous acts of God can lift us out of depression. I mean, and we're not going to, unfortunately, God doesn't show up in the form of an earthquake and a fire and tear the mountains apart for us. But he's got all these events when he did do that recorded in the Bible. And there's great value in reading about the mighty acts of God. I mean, why should we're not supposed to go through those stories just because, you know, to teach a Bible class or to read to our kids. They really are there to help encourage us in moments when we have doubts, maybe in confidence that God's really there, or that he has the power to deliver us in impossible situations. But as this story says, God was not in any of those things. He was not in the wind, he wasn't in the earthquake, and he wasn't in the fire. And I think his next lesson to help Elijah was in this soft wind, this gentle blowing wind. And it came about when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in the mantle and he went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and he said, "Elijah, what are you doing?" He still struggled with it. I mean, he still struggled with it. He says, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant and torn down thy altars and killed thy prophets with a sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So it doesn't just like, you know, make an instantaneous change in him. But I think the lesson here, when God appears to him in that gentle blowing breeze, was to say that he needed to trust the Lord even when he didn't see anything dramatic or spectacular being done. When we don't see God working in our lives, sometimes we can be discouraged. We can interpret him as missing, or that he's abandoned us, or that he's indifferent to our needs, and or that we're not important to him, or that he's lost faith in us. Something negative. When we can't see great things happening in our life and say, yes, God is working in my life, it's very easy to get discouraged and think he's just not there. And I think much of the church growth schemes today are dependent on keeping people mesmerized with spectacular things. They specialize in emotional highs. You know, you can see God working in this church because look, we're speaking in tongues. Look at the powerful miracles that God's doing, the alleged miracles that He works in these, a lot of times, Pentecostal churches. The huge numerical growth. Look at the growth. Look at all these people coming. You know, and they say, see, this is God's working. See it? You know, it's happening. He's here among us. He's doing great things. Well, nobody can be depressed with that, can they? I mean, you know, how could you be? You're just riding on cloud nine. Every time you go to a worship service, there's these marvelous, incredible things that are allegedly happening. And it is true that God did work in dramatic ways. At times. He did come down on Mount Sinai. He did part the Red Sea. Jesus was raised from the dead. 3,000 were converted on the day of Pentecost. Those are great and marvelous events. And I think he will do amazing things in our life at times and make us stop and just shake our heads and say, you know, the Lord is definitely helping me. But to Elijah, God says, that's not the only way. In fact, it's not even the rule for how God works in people's lives. He doesn't do things dramatic and spectacular all the time in people's lives. God can work very quietly through little, insignificant, imperceptible things. I'm not going to go back to it right now, but even on Wednesday night when we're studying in the book of Isaiah about God's deliverance of Judah from the Assyrian army. And the Assyrians sent a letter to Hezekiah and said, you better surrender or you're dead. We're going to come and wipe this place out. And they're just right outside the gates. I mean, they are there. And Elijah takes his letter before the Lord and he says, What are you going to do about this? What are we going to do here? He says, We can't do anything. We're helpless. And the Lord says, don't you worry about it. He said, because I'm going to put a spirit in that king, and he's going to turn around and he's going to take his armies and he's going to leave. And that's exactly what happened. He heard a rumor that things were happening back in his home country. There were plots and conspiracies against him. And he took his armies and he backed away from Jerusalem and left. That was not an earth-shaking event that God used to call the Assyrians away from his people. All he had to do was just put a little bit of a... I don't know, a rumor in his mind, and he left. A vague uneasiness, I put in Sennacherib, that was affected by a rumor. And so sometimes God is just working in ways that we don't perceive. He works through His Word sometime, in the heart of somebody, something that we can't literally see happening. Fruit is being born in that heart. It's being produced, but it takes time and maturity for those things to develop and for things to be seen. It's so subtle that we don't detect it by sight. And in times of discouragement, I think we need to trust the Lord that He's working, always working, but imperceptibly. And He doesn't need to tell us exactly what He's doing to make us aware that He's working in our lives. So, He showed him that God works in quiet and sometimes imperceptible ways, but He's working nonetheless. And then the next thing He does is He gives him a job to do. He gives Elijah something to do. In verse 15, it says, the Lord said to him, go and return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram. And Jehu the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat, the Abel-Mehola, you shall anoint as a prophet and in your place. And then you shall come about, one who escapes from the sword of Ahaziel, Jehu shall put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. And so he says, I got a job for you. He sent him to anoint two kings and anoint Elisha to be the prophet that would be his successor. So he said, Elijah, I got work for you to do. And I simply don't have time for you to sit around here and lament. There's a lot to do and things on my agenda. You know, but when we sit around, and that can be the worst possible thing we can do sometimes, is when we sit around and we mull over our thoughts, we discourage ourselves with things that are going on that are difficult, then we become stagnant and we become useless and we become despondent and we have despair. But you know, it's very difficult to stay depressed when you're active, when you're busy doing something for somebody else. And you need to make a list. Maybe you need to make a list of good things that you can do for the Lord. Maybe you need to visit the elderly. Just make a list. You need to visit some of the widows. Or take food to somebody or call somebody that needs a burden bearer. Instead of you being the one with the burden that everybody else needs to bear, you need to call somebody else and be a burden bearer for somebody else. Write a note. Tell somebody that you're thinking about it. Positive thing to do. Invite somebody over. Take somebody out for dinner who needs uplifted. Call somebody. Ask them how something turned out. Call Bradford. Ask him how things are going in his life. How things are going with his family. And congratulate them and rejoice with them. Don't beat yourself up for mistakes. Lighten your load. Reprioritize things. What's most important? Challenge yourself with something spiritual that you've never done before. Ask God's forgiveness and pray for His blessings as you go back to work for Him. But we need to be, what Paul said, we need to be steadfast and immovable and always abounding in the work of the Lord, because our labor is not in vain in the Lord, he said. So we need to do something. We need to be busy about the Lord's work. That's a positive thing to do, to help people come out of a situation of discouragement. And that's what God did with Elijah. He gave him work. And then he just needed reminded that there were really a lot more people that were faithful than he thought. He had to correct him on a little calculation error. And he says in verse 18, "Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." Elijah did not perceive that there were more people out there serving the Lord than he imagined. He was observing in his mind that he was really the only one. And that was not true. And when we are discouraged, sometimes we can think that everybody else is against us. And nobody likes me, and everybody's out to get me, and you know, I'm the only one who really loves the Lord and is being faithful around here. And we need to recognize that that's just not true. There are a lot of good things that are out there as well as bad things. And instead of isolating ourselves too, which is something that Elijah did, instead of isolating ourselves in when we have moments of depression, those are the very moments maybe that we need more than any other time to be in the company of other brethren. There were 7,000 people out there that served the Lord. It'd been, you know, Elijah, sometimes you have to work alone, but sometimes you need to be in the company of other people who are trying to serve him. And we may not feel the desire to go to church or to spend time with others, but if we do, very often it will help us to break that depression. We look at, you know, other people who are trying to serve the Lord, and we think, I am not the only one. There are other people. Paul, in difficult moments, was writing letters to brethren like in Philippi, and he was saying, I rejoice at the thought of you because you are serving the Lord. And that was great. It really lifted him up in a time when he could have been very discouraged. And so, you know, I want to conclude just by saying, you know, Christians do get discouraged. Great servants of the Lord get discouraged. Elijah had a nature like our own. They share in the same strengths that we have, and they shared in the same weaknesses that we have. We are not infidels because we have doubts at times, or because we have moments of discouragement or despondency or despair. All of these faithful men had moments when they went through those. Nobody is above that. perhaps you've fought some mighty battles against them and have been victorious, only to find that the circumstances of your life have not changed all that much. God's message is the same for us today. We can grieve over sin in our world, but don't let that grief cripple us to the point that we can't move forward to the tasks that He's got for us to do. Jesus is a sympathetic high priest. That's an encouraging verse to people who are discouraged. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15. He's been tempted in all points like we have. He says, so you can find grace and you can find mercy in your time of need. Well, this evening, if that's hopefully that'd be helpful to you in that study. And if you're not a Christian, coming to Christ and becoming a Christian can be a great encouragement to you. It can strengthen you and give you hope and give you expectations of a better future, especially an eternal future. And we would encourage you, if you're not a Christian, to make a decision and a commitment to be a follower of Jesus. But that commitment does not mean that you won't have moments of discouragement. In fact, I always say that the very reason the devil met Jesus immediately after he was baptized, when he went into the wilderness, was because the devil lost a client and he wanted to get him back. And he was ready to tempt him, because the only thing the devil can do is to rob God of the one that he has gained as a faithful servant. And he's going to try to do that. So that can be, he can use different techniques, and one of those can be to bring you to a state of depression and discouragement. We need to fight against that and turn to the Lord for strength instead of looking to ourselves for that. So tonight, if you would be interested in responding to the Lord's invitation, then we invite you to come while we stand and sing our